modeling cell cell reactions with discrete physical elements. And this is all work in collaboration with Professor Hans Olsen, who's at the University of Minnesota. So we're going to get a break from angiogenesis in this talk because I don't do angiogenesis, but I hope that you'll
see.
Yes. So I hope that you'll see that many of the things in this model could apply to the process of angiogenesis and the things that have been spoken about at this conference. And in fact, there are some things that are very applicable to it. There have been some very interesting talks that I've found, even though I don't do angiogenesis. Okay, so basically, I'll start out with the biological applications that I'm looking at, and then I'll discuss the model, and briefly discuss the numerical methods, and then talk about some results in one of the systems, because I only have results in one of the systems, and then some things that I'm trying to do this summer. So the applications are, first, Dictyostelium and Discoideum, and that's the main one, and that's the thing I know the most about. And then wound healing, and finally, morphogenesis, and how the patterns form in the embryo. Well, various things. So I'll discuss each of these in turn. So Dictyostelium and Discoideum, for those of you who don't know, it's a widely studied system in biology, and it's a type of cellular slime mold. Under good conditions, they're amoeba, and they feed on bacteria. And when they're starved, they undergo this developmental change, which is what makes them of great interest. And there are several reasons, I guess there's some actually technical reasons. They're easy to do things within the laboratory. But then they exhibit behaviors which are very interesting. And so if you starve them for about 8 hours, then they go through this developmental cycle. And after about 8 hours, they gain two abilities. One is they become chemotactically sensitive to cyclic AMP. And the other ability is they become relay competent, which by that I mean when they sense cyclic AMP, they will put out their own burst of cyclic AMP. So if you spread these in a petri dish and you stimulate it with cyclic AMP, it forms an excitable medium and it propagates waves. But then they're chemotactically sensitive to the waves. And so then they start reorganizing themselves according to these waves. So when you starve them, then they gain these two abilities, and after about 4 hours, then they start to, you see patterns like this, and I believe the light are the moving cells, because when they move, then they change their optical properties, so you can see them. And then about 6 hours, you can see, this is a magnification course, and they have these streams, and they're coming into these centers, and the object is, originally they're identical cells, but now that they're starving, they aggregate into a center, they form a mound, they start to differentiate, and they form a slug, and so these are typically like 10,000 cells, and they act in a coordinated manner for the slug to sort of move along, and then at some point it stops, and the cells have started to differentiate somewhere back in here, and the pre-stalk cells push down through the other cells, which are pre-spore cells, and they form a fruiting body, and the stalk cells die, and the spore cells are up higher.
There's a cycle there, maybe.
The spore cells are up higher, and they then are dispersed and start the life cycle over. Okay. So this is what happens. And so, of course, there's this chemotactic ability, and the all these individual cells act in a coordinated manner to move together and form sort of an organism. And the differentiation, these are all interesting aspects. And for this talk, I'm really interested in these sorts of pictures where you have these cell-cell interactions. Yes?
Where do you actually see these outside of labs? Are they common in cities? You have to go to the...
Yeah, no, I guess in forests. They live in the undergrowth. So I don't, because you need to ask about this, I'm a mathematician. But so at one time, they were native to, I think they originally found in the Midwest, or like Indiana or somewhere like that, in the forest, and live in decaying debris in the forest. So that's where I guess you would find them. I think there's probably a larger population now in laboratories. But yes?
What was going on in that dark circle?
This is just a void. There are no cells here. And so these are the cells. They're streaming in. It's actually streaming in a little loop like this.
So the picture above the dark space?
No, this is the magnification. This is earlier on. So here, these are cells. These are moving cells. And they move and you have these target these off. Maybe this will help. So this is from a laboratory in Dundee. Yeah. And so here you can see, so here's the earlier stage where you get these waves of cells moving according to this, they're sort of spread out. They start to reorganize, and eventually they clump into these streams, and the streams move into these centers. And then the centers form a slug, and then the slug sort of moves along. So here there's sort of cells everywhere. Here the cells are in the stream, so they're, you know, it's a region void of cells. And then you have this. So that.
They're sort of birefringent, you know what that means? And so when they're sort of, when they're spread a little flatter, they have different birefringence than when they're plumper. And that's what the distinct, that's what the optical distinction is.
Yeah, so you can see these different, when they start to move, they sort of they elongate, I guess, that's right. Okay. So, I'm interested in this, how they move when they're in the slug form, or even in the cell part. So here's another picture again from the laboratory in the Case Byers lab. And you can see it's very dynamic. I mean, you know, there's lots of activity going on here as this moves up. But this is just, you know, this is a sort of a solid mass of cells. And this is form, starting to form a fruiting block. That's when the slug stops.
What's the color on this?
So, yeah, I don't know what the color differentiation is. I mean, the important part for me is just to see how, you know, you get all these cells are just sort of moving and mixing. They are able to.
If I had to guess, I would guess that it's a GFP expression driven by something that has to do with the next forming the spores, perhaps. So that's the fruiting body. So my guess is that there's.
Yeah. So this would be, these would be the pre-spore cells, and these are the pre-stalks. Yes. Because so then these push down and raise this up. So that can spawn some sort of. And now this is from a laboratory in Connecticut. So I've just taken all these from the web. So this is an earlier stage, but this is in the, when you get a stream of cells. But you can see they're sort of crawling on top of each other and through each other and around each other. And this is very interesting.
How many cells are there in this formation?
So in a typical, it depends upon. A typical slug is maybe 10,000 cells. So, but they can form slugs, very small slugs actually. I think even less than 100 cells, they can form very small slugs. I don't know what they look like a slug exactly, but I mean, you can make the life cycle go on with varying sizes. But a typical one would be 10,000. Okay, so. The other application is wound healing. There are two parts of the wound healing. And the first one is, again, cell-cell interaction, but this is in epithelial cell sheets. So this is from a lab in Chicago. And they plate these sheets out, and they cause a little wound, scrape out a little interior region, and then after 6 hours, the other cells have moved into the region, so healed the wound, and you see after 18 hours. And this is not cell proliferation, although there's a little bit of cell proliferation going on, but if they stop the cell proliferation, this still occurs. So it's mainly by cell movement that what's going on here is mainly cell movement. And so then we can see this movie of the leading edge that's moving into it. This is the wounded region. And you can see the cells.
These are plated on what?
I don't know.
But they're like on plastic or something?
Yeah, they're on something.
There's a lamella podium.
Yeah, you can see them. Well, you could see
right
them.
Up there. Yeah, where you
can. Yeah. So then they've done various experiments, which I'll talk about at the end, because this is the system that I'm trying to do some stuff this summer to learn more about. So I'll talk about that a little later. The other area of wound healing is more of what I have concentrated research on, but this isn't quite ready for it. And this is dermal wound healing. So here is a cross-section of the skin. So here you have on top of your skin, this is going deep, and here you have a blood clot, you have a slash wound. And this is the epidermis. And the epidermis is tightly packed with cells, and that's sort of the thing you just saw before, although there I think it was a monolayer of cells pretty much. Here's not a mono, you know, it has some depth, but it's tightly packed. So if you have a superficial scratch that doesn't really bleed, you probably have only gone through this layer, gone into this layer. But if you get deeper and you bleed, and you go into the dermis, and the dermis is different from the epidermis. It's relatively acellular compared to this. There's much more extracellular matrix material, and you have cells called fibroblasts, and the fibroblasts invade into the blood clot, and they replace the fibrin clot with a collagen matrix, and that's how you repair your tissue. And so this is what I'm quite interested in scar tissue formation. And here, it's not the cell-cell interactions that are so important, but it's the cell-extracellular matrix interactions. And this is very similar to what was talked about on Monday, where they had the speaker had the cells and they contracted the gels. And so I'm very interested in that sort of thing, although I want to do it with a discrete formulation, so I want to not have a uniform density of cells and stuff in PDEs, but these discrete cells, and I want some sort of discrete representation of the fiber structure, and then watch and see how the forces modify these sorts of things. So that's what I'm interested in. And something that's been discussed a little bit at this conference is sort of the, you know, in angiogenesis, where you have the these chemical factors which are causing all sorts of things to go on. Then as this one speaker talked about how there's also these tractional forces and these forces where the gel is being contracted and moving. And that happens in wound healing here in scar tissue formation. And I'm quite interested to know how important, what the relative importance of each of these are on the final pattern. And so hope I have some modeling with the chemical, biochemical things going on. And with this, I'm hoping to be able to access the forces that are happening and then sort of put them together and see what the relative importance of those two things are. And if one can say one is more important or if they're both very important. And then so then this is just a picture of some fibroblasts in the collagen. So with this, I have another formulation of the extracellular matrix, which I won't talk about today, but I have to merge it with the model that I'm going to talk about today, which is cell-cell interactions. And when I do that, then I can actually access this sort of. And then the final thing that this seems very lends itself to is morphogenesis. And so a speaker yesterday spoke a little bit about this. And so Ray Keller at the University of Virginia has these pictures. And in as the embryo forms, you have this convergence and extension. So convergence is when the, and it takes place by a process called interpolation. And so here's the picture. You have these cells, and they sort of move in between these other cells. And as a result, the tissue narrows in this direction and lengthens in this direction. So it converges and extends, and this happens by interpolation. And this is very important in how the embryo forms. We saw pictures from the speaker yesterday of these sheets of cells. So he talked about it being a sandwich, but you have these sheets which are moving and being deformed all the time. And so again, the sort of model I'm talking about, I want to be able to model these, have these clumps of cells and look at the forces as they pull and tug on each other and see how the tissue behaves. So then again, you can see some movies, and these are from the University of Wisconsin, Jeff Harden. And I don't know much about them except that you have your cells here, and here they're sort of wedged between each other, but then they sort of move in, and you can see it narrows in the one direction and lengthens in the other, and you get quite a changing, you know, the shape of the embryo is very important and how it changes, and this is all due to the forces which the cells are exerting on each other.
What species is it?
It said something at the beginning.
Something with an embryo.
Aren't those aren't they amphibian?
I think they're amphibian.
They're amphistema, I think.
Right? I think they're amphibian, but I don't know.
Yeah, they're an amphibian. They're like a salamander, like amphibian. They call them amphistema, which is pretty true.
And so then here's one more picture of the same process, just a different visualizing. So here you have the lighter cells, and the darker cells are going to insert themselves between in this process of interpolation. And then the process change the shape of the embryo. So these are the main applications I've been thinking of, but I think they have lots of applications actually in angiogenesis as well. Okay, so the model. The model was originally developed by America Paulson and Hans Ofmer, and they are responsible for these sort of original ideas, and then we've changed the implementation and a few things. So the basic framework of the model is first the cells are oriented ellipsoids. They are viscoelastic in nature, and I'll go back and discuss each of these in turn. And the cells move in three space according to Newton's second law. The interactions that we consider in the model cell adhesion interactions, active cell motion, and interaction due to the physical presence of cells. So cells are oriented ellipsoids. So here we have, they're constrained to be ellipsoids, but the axes of ellipsoids can be any length. So they originally start out as spheres, and then depending upon the forces exerted on them, they will change their shape, but they'll always be an ellipsoidal shape. And the cell knows which side is its front. It has a front, so it's oriented. And it wants to, so I anthropomorphize my cells, I'm sorry, but it moves in this direction. And the model requires two stimulus. So one is a stimulus to move, and so it just says you should be moving, and the other one is an orientation stimulus, which says you should be moving in this direction. Now for cyclic AMP, for dictyostelium and discoideum, these both come from the same chemical field, but they're different characteristics of the chemical field. The first one is a temporal derivative. When the time derivative of the cyclic AMP changes enough, then cells are signaled to move, and then they move in a spatial up the spatial gradient of the cyclic AMP, and that's how they get their directional orientation. So they're separate signals, but from the same chemical field. But this, of course, the simulation, the model doesn't care. You just give these two signals.
So you don't model how they move, you just assume they move?
No. So I model the forces. I don't model what. I'm modeling the forces. So I say this cell wants to move in this, but it wants to move in a certain direction, so it exerts forces to move in that direction, and then sort of see how the forces cause the whole tissue to move. But anything before that, no, I don't necessarily know. That all comes in these two pieces. So, for example, you have a two-dimensional cell here, which is an ellipse, and this is its front end, and it, is moving up, would move in this direction, but the orientation stimulus says it should move in this direction. So if there are no other cells around it, it would start moving off and then be rotated and turn off and sort of go off in that direction. But then when you have other cells, then different things happen. Or when you have other cells around. So cells are oriented ellipsoids. Cells are viscoelastic in nature. So viscoelastic, but if you have a viscoelastic substance, if you originally try to deform it, it resists deformation, but then it will slowly deform. And depending upon how you model it, it can either retain the deformed shape, or it will have a memory and return to its old shape. And so we actually consider the cells as sort of biphasic. They're sort of, and this is very simplistic, but sort of the cytoskeletal structure and then the fluid. And they behave differently and on different time scales. And so one we sort of assume happens instantaneously, and the other one happens at a slower time scale. So the cytoskeletal structure is modeled by having standard linear solids or Kelvin bodies for each of the axes of the ellipsoid. And so, what is that?
How did you decide on this?
How did I decide on the standard linear solid?
Standard solid.
Well, I was just sort of, I had either a Maxwell element, a Voigt element, or a standard, those are the sort of things that
I know, but things like neutrophils, which are amoeboid to some extent, they don't fit this model except a very, very small definition.
Well, that's right. That's true. So, I mean, they deform their cytoskeleton, right? They change, the cell starts to move off and it changes its entire internal structure to move off in that direction. Well, that I'm not going to model that initially.
No, the point was that we've done quite a lot of experiments on cell mechanics for neutrophils. And when neutrophils flow through the bloodstream, they're in a viscous element, a cortical tension, which is not an elastic element. There can be.
Right. Well, so the cortical tension, I'm not quite sure what you mean by the cortical tension, but
it's equivalent to a surface tension on liquid gel.
The biphasic nature, I do have some sort of, there's a membrane around it which causes some things to happen, and I'll talk about it in a second.
But then it makes a transformation to this active state, which is then very rigid,
right.
In lamellar body.
Right. Well, so. I understand it's very complicated, and I'm just going
into it. Person.
Well, okay, but you can. Could maybe argue that I think it's actually quite complicated, but the cytoskeletal structure as it reorganizes and changes, then you're going to have different sort of very different properties.
Well,
I'm just saying
it's easy to define that. We've got some information on how neutrophils behave in their crawling and eating and phagocytosis and everything, and then you could build that in. We'd have to have data.
Yeah. Well. Okay. So. The reason I chose a standard linear solid was because it will return to its original shape, as opposed to the other
when it will return to the treatment state because it's got a tension that works against the viscosity to bring it back to the sphere.
Yeah, and so well, but this is in terms of the other viscoelastic elements which I was considering.
This is a solid rubber ball.
This is, yeah, well, that's basically it's very much
like that kind of thing.
That's well, it, yeah, well, okay, it's actually fluid filled with fluid, so it's a little different than that. But, so with the standard linear solid, you can write down the equations, and so this is a first order differential equation. And you can either think of it as an equation in F, where F is the unknown, which is the force. Oh, so I hit myself. So the standard linear solid is a Maxwell element in parallel with a spring. So in our case, this is a nonlinear spring. And a Maxwell element is a spring in series with a dashpot. Now, a dashpot just says that the force is proportional to the velocity. A spring force is proportional to the displacement. And so you have this Maxwell element in parallel with a nonlinear spring, and this forms a standard linear solid. And you write down the equations for this, and here's the equation. And so if you apply the force to try and stretch the element, and you don't know what that force is, but you know what the length is, you can determine the force. Or if you know what the length is, and you want to see what the force is that the cell resists the stretching, you can do it that way as well. And so then you get this standard sort of graphs, which are creep and relaxation functions. And so the creep function is when you say, okay, I know the force, and now I want to look at the length. So if you put a step force, you turn a force on, you immediately start trying to stretch it with a constant force for a certain duration, then the length of the element changes like this. You take the force off, and then it relaxes back down because of that spring in parallel. It will go back to its original the original size of the element. If you want to do that's the creep function. The relaxation function does it the other way around. It says, okay, let's immediately stretch and force the cell to be this length. So you, at this point, you suddenly stretch the cell, and then you look at the force that the cell, how the cell resists that stretching. And there's immediately a spike of force. And then as the dashpot relaxes and lets the spring in series with it go back to its original shape, you have a decrease in force until you're at the steady state force, which is caused by the spring in parallel, which is always stretched at the length that you stretched your element to. Yes?
Is there a part of this that, maybe this is a naive question, but in terms of math, but is there a flip side of this sort of for compression? Because there's, pretty obvious there's places where cells get in convergent extension, for example, where it's not a stretch.
Yeah, you can compress this and the force, you just get different, you know, you compress it and it resists that, it pushes back out, or you stretch and it pulls back in. So it doesn't matter whether you're compressing or stretching, it works either way. The force has just changed direction. So the other part, so if you did this and you have these cells and you started to push on them, each of the axes is decoupled. These are independent problems. And we don't want that. So these are sort of filled with some sort of fluid, and we assume they have a constant volume. And so as a result, the volume causes some sort of pressure. So I don't have a multimedia demonstration if I don't hyperventilate myself. So if you have your balloon, and if it were filled with water, I don't want to get wet, so I don't do water. It should be an incompressible fluid. But if I push on one side, the other side will expand out. Or if I were to pull, the other side would sort of pull in. And so this fluid, by filling with the fluid and having a constant volume, we create a pressure. And so it couples these three axes. So if you push on this, then the fluid will push, try and lengthen that one. And so you can get sort of this behavior.
But that's why this model didn't work. Because of the membrane, it's got excess area, it's got a cortical tension.
Oh yeah.
There's a limit to what you can put a stress on, and then it's all viscous deformation.
No, I agree absolutely. So if you do very small perturbations, this works. Well, the fluid maybe not. I mean, the viscous.
Right.
But for larger perturbations, yeah. But this is just the first approximation.
Well, we've got some videos. We'll show you.
Actually, I didn't understand that comment.
Yeah, it can change the surface,
right.
The surface area, although this can change the surface area too. It's the volume.
It's not a tight bag with an elastic constant to deformation.
Well, yeah, but although it can change, if the volume is constant in my model, certainly the surface area changes as well.
No,
but
this works for your model.
I understand, but so for cells can change their surface area. They can actually change their volume as well. I'm just assuming they have a constant volume. Mine allows for changing in the surface area, But it doesn't assume there are lots of folds and ripples, so it's easy for it to expand out. Doesn't you? But you can sort of, if you want to, you can think of lamellipodian stuff being external to this, maybe this being sort of a core of the cell, and whether that's a better way to think of it, I don't know.
Yeah.
But that's certainly how I'm thinking of it. And you know, I want to get down to the forces of this more complicated interacting system. Yes.
So John, are you driving toward a goal or something here where you want to consider tissue? Is that
yeah, I want to look at the tissue.
Polymorphonuclear leukocytes do not form the tissue. They're independent agents.
Okay. Yeah. So it's very much the speaker yesterday spoke about the cell-based models, and you can take all of his slides and put them in here. I agree fully. You know, a cell-based model, you can say, okay, I want to.
Cancer cells do, but they don't understand that.
They don't. Cancer cells form a tissue.
Okay.
So you, but you can.
You got videos. I've got videos. We'll swap our videos.
Yeah. So the speaker
got the real thing.
The speaker before was saying that, you know, cell-based models allow you to modify the properties of individual cells, and then you can look at the behavior macroscopically of the tissue and how the tissue, the differences in the tissue and stuff. And I agree fully with that sort of attitude, and that's really what I want to do here is I have these individual cells and I will change the force, how they exert forces and stuff, and then look at how that affects the overall composition of the tissue. And that's what I'm interested in. And I realize that, you know, lots of this is very simplistic. I'm, you know, just happy to get something going that will actually maybe tell me something, so and make it more sophisticated. Okay. So the third part of the model is the motion is just described by the Lindsay model, which is Maston's acceleration secret forces acting on the cell. So what are the forces that we consider? So we consider cell adhesion. We consider active cell motion. This is when a cell expends energy to move in some sort of direction. And interaction due to the physical presence of cells. Okay, so cell adhesion. So again, with cell adhesion, we break it into two different types of forces. And again, this is artificial, but this was a simple thing to do. So as you have these cells and they move along each other, they're less resistant, so it's the cell adhesion, they're less resistant to motion tangential to the membrane than motion normal to the membrane. So, you know, they want to keep their membranes in contact with each other, but they will sort of move along like this. So we break it into two different components, and this is not really what's happening, but this is how we're modeling it. And so we have this dynamic drag and the static friction. And the static friction is normal to the membrane, so it prevents the membranes from being pulled apart. And then the dynamic drag is tangential to the membranes, so it allows sliding along membranes. If you have more adhesive sites, then it's going to slide, you know, more, it's going to slide, there will be a greater drag. We also have some other drags. So we'll talk about that for a second. These cells are assumed to be either in contact with fluid, so the cell membrane is either in contact with fluid, a substrate, or other cells. So if it's in contact with the fluid, then there really is a drag with the fluid. If it's in contact with other cells, then tangential to the membrane, the motion tangential to the membrane is modeled as a drag, and that's really cell adhesion. And the same thing with the surface of the if it's in contact with the substrate, it's adhering to the substrate, but as it moves along, it we model that as some sort of a drag. And drag is very complicated. It depends on the texture of the membrane and the shape and velocity and all that stuff. Okay, so active cell motion. When the cell decides to move, we have two motions for the active cell motion. There's the tractional force and the motive force. And so basically, when the cell decides it wants to move in a direction, it generates a force trying to move in that direction. And so you could do various things. We do a sort of grappling hook. So you think of this ellipsoid as maybe being the center of the cell. A cell will reach out with a pseudopod attached to something and then sort of pull on it, trying to move forward. And so we don't have a pseudopod in our model. But so it sort of reaches out with a grappling hook or something, grabs onto something, and exerts a force and pulls on it. And that's the traction force. Well, if you know I pull on this, the thing that moves me is the opposite force that this is pulling back on me. That's how I move forward. And that's Newton's third law to every action. There's always the opposed and equal reaction, or the mutual actions of two bodies on each other are always equal and directed to contrary parts. So this just says that the traction force, so here, the first subscript indicates the source of the force, and the second is what the force is acting on. So the traction force of cell I, so if I'm cell I, I exert attractional force on cell J. Cell J will exert a motive force on me, equal and opposite direction. And that's the one. And that's actually what causes me to be pulled forward. Okay. And so likewise, there are these reactive forces in the next. And so interaction due to physical presence of cells. Here you also have a reactive force. So basically, if I'm a cell, I'm trying to move forward, and there's a cell in front of me, you know, it's going to block me. And it will either be pushing on me or pulling on me, depending upon whether it's contracting or expanding, and depending upon what I'm doing. And so there are these rheological forces due to the physical presence of the other cell and how it's moving and pushing. And so we have these forces. And so then it's very easy. We just sum all the forces. So you have, you know, the drag, forget the coefficient should be put in drag. The drag due to the fluid acting on cell I, the drag due to the substrate acting on cell I, the sum of the drags from all the other cells acting on cell I, the motive force due to the substrate on cell I, the reactive force from the cell is pushing on the substrate, so it sort of pushes back because the cell is expanding or something in that direction. So you have this, you have adhesive forces from the substrate on cell I, you have adhesive forces from the other cells, you have rheological forces from the other cells, you have the reactive rheological forces because I'm pushing on the cell, so it pushes back on me. You have the motive force from the other cells, and you have the traction forces from the other cells. And they're all acting on cell I, so you just have to solve the equations. Okay, but now I want to talk just a minute about Reynolds. So in fluid flow, Reynolds number is quite an important quantity for the Navier-Stokes equations in the fluid flow. It's defined to be this, where rho is the fluid density, L is some characteristic length scale, this is a characteristic velocity in your system.
Sir, this is the Reynolds number of what?
So if if you put the cell in a fluid moving around it, this would be the Reynolds number. If you want to think of it the other way and have the cell moving in a fluid, this would be the Reynolds number. A cell moving in water.
They're in a fluid.
So yeah, the cell is either in contact with a fluid, other cells, or a substrate. So
okay.
So if you look at the Reynolds number in water, but see it will just the viscosity of water will be less than if you want to think of the substrate as a fluid. Well, I wouldn't think of it as a fluid, but it will be more viscous than water. Or if you want to think of the other cells as fluid, they would be more viscous than water because of all these sort of attachments. So that would just make things smaller. So this is sort of like the largest estimate for my Reynolds number in my system if I were just in fluid.
Okay. In the model that you just wrote down, where was the fluid component?
So you have the drag from the fluid. It depends on how much it's in. No, the cells are moving.
There's no equation for the fluid.
Yeah, that's right.
It's just like couldn't the cells induce a collective motion of the fluid?
They could, and I don't consider that. So if you're in, there are people who do immersed boundary who say you have to consider how the fluid is pushing back and stuff, and I'm not.
Okay.
So it might be important on boundary effects, but certainly if you're looking at sheets, it may be important, I'm not sure. But if I have a slug which is internal, cells internal to the slug, they're not necessarily in contact with lots of fluid. They're in contact with lots of other, I guess they're in contact with fluid too, but lots of other cells. So I think that's sort of dominating thing. But I'll show you why I'm talking about it.
Yeah.
I mean, so if you calculate this, you get a very small Reynolds number. And the point is the Reynolds number sort of tells you the inertial terms versus the viscous terms. So, you know, high Reynolds number is an airplane flying, and a low Reynolds number is a fly in molasses. And it basically says if the inertial term is strong compared to the viscous term, so airplane flying, the viscous terms aren't very strong compared to the inertial terms, or vice versa with the fly in the molasses, the inertial term. So I think of more as being in a pool. If you're in a pool of water and you push off from the side, you'll sort of drift out once you leave contact. But if you're in a pool of molasses and you don't push very hard, then you're not going to drift once you let go very much. That's not sort of Reynolds number. And if you're at low Reynolds number, then approximating the drag as being proportional to the velocity is a reasonable thing to do, and that's what we do. And
that's only true if you have an isolated sphere, nothing around it, just
for yeah, I don't
like that drag law only holds for a sphere isolated.
Yeah, if you have a sphere in a fluid, then I think it's drag.
With nothing else.
That's correct. That, yeah. So you have the flow. That's right.
If you have a lot of things.
Well, that's right. So if I'm a cell in the interior of my slug, I have mainly cells around me, so it's just a different fluid. If you want to think of other cells, sort of as a different fluid. But, I have this drag, and they're moving, but they sort of push back. But the drag force which I model, you know, this adhesive as they move tangentially along the other sub things. So you can think of being in a fluid of other cells at one level. But yeah, whether it's, I mean, the whole thing of splitting the adhesion into drag and a tangential drag and a static adhesive force normal is quite artificial anyway.
But
is
it necessary to move it? Because I could imagine that because now you have just a force and accelerations, so you force is proportional to action.
Yeah, I get rid of.
I mean, if you were,
I get rid of.
Your force plus response.
I'm going to get rid of the acceleration part in just a second.
Okay,
that's fine.
Okay.
So I mean, so I do model the drag like this, and whether that's realistic or not, this is how I'm modeling it. Yeah. Yes.
What is R in this?
This is the radius of the cell. Okay.
So you imagine the cell like floating somehow.
Yeah. I mean, so for all this, just thinking about the Reynolds number, I'm just thinking of a cell in fluid. But that, so, okay, forget the Reynolds number now. And I go back to my equations, and if you do the non-dimensionalization, you see that this is a very small quantity compared to this, and these are, I'm not sure what the magnitude of these are, but they're larger than this. So I can just ignore this. So I'm just going to say sum of forces n equal to zero, and that's exactly what I'm doing. And so this is justification for this more than anything, but I also do model the drags as proportional to the velocity.
And numerically, this is advantageous since the system, the full system would be rather stiff, I guess.
Yeah, well, even the system is stiff. I mean, so this gives me a first order differential equation in position as opposed to a second order differential equation. But it's senseless to do the more work, really, because if you take a cell and you remove all those forces from it, it drifts a matter of nanometers as opposed to, you know,
so basically, you are using the force loss for this force.
Okay. So the basic idea is you have this cell, it wants to move in this direction, it grasps onto whatever, it first grabs onto the substrate, but if it can't, it will grasp onto whatever cell is closest to that direction and pull on that cell, trying to move that way. Of course, all these other cells want to move in some direction and pull, and you know, so they're pulling and tugging and they're expanding and changing shape, and so you use the solid force equations and see what happens. Okay, so the numerical methods. So, basically, I solve it two ways, so I've written a linear, but this is, I mean, M really is a function of these other things. So, but we've done it two ways. It's actually a quasi-implicit trapezoidal rule because there's one part that's lag that's not truly implicit, and a predictor corrector. And all the simulations you see today are from the predictor corrector because they have to work computationally, they're much more efficient. And so I'll skip this slide because it's sort of confusing.
Are you going to finish that sentence?
What? No. So I mean, it's.
And then a miracle happens.
That's right. I can't solve this explicitly, so I can't really do the. If you do the implicit trapezoidal rule with a nonlinear solver the way I was doing it, it's a little bit unstable. But if you lag it, if you lag the radius of the cells, but use the most current information that you have, but not make it fully implicit, then you can actually make it stable and it works well, although it still takes a lot of computational time and it's not set very well there, which is why I want to see that. And it's not set very well here either, which is why I want to see that. Okay, so the basic results I have are in the system of Dickerson discoidium, and then I'll talk just a little bit about the wound healing machines. So in Dickerson discoidium, we have these slugs, and so I'll show you the simple movie. So here, the direct orientation stimulus is to move off in this direction always. And the cells which are in the plane of these raised squares or triangles, depending on what your orientation is, are the ones which are being stimulated to move. And this is sort of what happens in the slug. You have these waves of cyclic AMP which are propagating from the tip back. And it's more complicated than that. This was just, I'm more interested in the, I just want to see the slug sort of move along. And you can sort of see the slug move along. And this is quite a small slug. But this gives me hope that my model will actually characterize the tissue, the behavior of the entire mass. And here is one which I haven't done much with. I haven't done much with this. But here's one where actually, so in other work, which I've done and other people have done, we have done the signal transduction pathway. So this is the signaling of why the cells move. So this cyclic AMP, how they respond to that. And so if you put that in, And so here's only the each cell, there's a signal cascade which is going on in each cell with these ODEs that tell it how to respond to, how it should output its own chemical signal. So you get this wave of cyclic AMP. The diffusion is hokey here. I mean, it's an averaging of cells nearby. It's not real diffusion in the tree space. But other than that, so then you have this signal propagating through this mass of cells, and then they reorganize themselves according to the signal. And you know,
why are they separate?
Just because they want to, you know, this splits off this way and this way, and so they're sort of moving this way and this way, and so they pull apart.
This is supposed to model a food and body,
right? No, not this. This I just had a bunch. They weren't initially, well, I have put the initial conditions. This isn't quite there yet. But so you have the cells, and whether if they're close enough, then they might have enough adhesive contact to stay together. If they're not close enough, then if the signal push them apart a little bit, then they'll separate. It depends upon what the adhesion is and how the forces go. Yeah, so you do get the splitting. And in the natural case, you would have some, depending upon how the wave is going, you might have some separation, but eventually it would all aggregate into a cluster. But like I said, I haven't done much with this. But the point of this is just to show you, you can couple this with more complicated signal dynamics to get these waves, and, you know, to get the, I'm just thinking of the force interactions for this model, and you can add these other parts into it.
Is there chemotaxis in this?
Pardon me?
Is there chemotaxis in this model now?
Yeah, so now the orientation direction is determined by the cyclic AMP gradient.
Yeah.
And the motion signal is determined by the cyclic AMP time derivative. And the cyclic AMP is now being modeled with this other sort of system. The only thing, the diffusion's a little bit hokey in this. But
how many cells are there?
I don't know how many.
Roughly.
In this one, I can't remember. So I don't know. Okay. So then the other application I want to look at is morphogenesis. And so I want to see if this, you know, I can do the convergence extension, this intercalation business. So here I just put in this, the cells want to move into this plane. They have an orientation signal that's moving them into the plane, and they're just always moving. So they sort of jiggle and jostle and sort of move in. So this gives me hope that the simulation might be able to do something. Nothing, that was just for me. It was just to see how, it was sort of to see how the different lines sort of interdigitated. But it's very, the colors are pretty
impressive. Who drives them through
the line? This is just very artificial. I just say, you want to move into this line. So I give an orientation stimulus, you always want to be moving it towards this line, and you always want to be moving. So this is, but this is what I would like
gravity,
to.
Gravity, basically.
Yeah, sure. So this is what I would like to investigate more later, is, you know, then start changing some rules and say, what sort of rules would cause, what can cause this and what can't, or, you know, what sort of things. And I'll talk,
Do you have some random factor in there, or the
there's rand. So the it depends. So you know, the orientation stimulus can be perturbed. You can have a random perturbation. So you want to move in this direction, but then you perturb it a little bit randomly, and the forces are all randomly perturbed, so they're not all pulling and tugging on each other. So you don't get some sort of static.
But how dependent is the system on this randomness?
It's quite actually important to have some random, and you can anticipate this. If you have two cells right next to each other and there's no random motion and they're trying to pull on each other, they don't move. But if you put a little bit of random motion, then they can sort of move around each other, you know, if you vary the direction. And also, if you have two cells, if all the cells have the same force, exactly the same force, when they start pulling on and tugging each other, you get into these states where they just sort of stop because the force is all
over. In reality, where would that randomness
Oh, it's very, the signals are very, you know, I mean, the cells are, two cells don't have exactly the same forces, and they don't have exactly, they're not moving off in exactly the same direction. I mean, I don't know where the randomness comes from, but this real system is very random. There's, you know, lots of noise going on.
I mean, the cells are always, I think
they're sort of moving. There's a propensity for it to move in this direction, but it sort of wanders off, you know, it curves and does things. There's lots of random stuff going on in the real system. What we've been able to talk about, what the first application is with Dictyostin discoideum. And so in a way, and some people in Japan have measured the motive force of the slug. And the way they did this is they put these capillary, they drilled little holes in agar and then sent the slugs in these holes, and they would pressurize one side and see when the slugs stalled. And then from that they could determine the force. But it, of course, I guess as most experiments are, I don't know, but you know, it's much more complicated than that. So they actually couldn't really stall the slug, because if the pressure were enough, then fluids started going, you know, they started forming things and it didn't work out. Then they also had another setup where they would spin the agar. So then as you change the radius, then the force changes. But again, they couldn't go all the way to stalling of the slug because of the deformation of the agar and various reasons. But they could take some data points and they extrapolated that. And from that, they calculated the motive force. And what they learned is that, so this is what we'll look at, the motive force is proportional to the volume of the slug. Well, now this seems a little strange to some of us, I think, because here you have a bunch of cells in a blob of other cells, and so the internal cells are contributing to motive force, but they're pulling and tugging on other cells. Where are they getting their traction from, or how are they transmitting their forces to the substrate? That's the question, and that's what we understand. But you might think that, okay, well, if you have these cells which become stiff, you know, if I push really quick on it, it's a little bit stiff, it resists the deformation. So maybe I can transfer the forces all the way to the substrate. So we ran some simulations to try and do this and could not do it. So we got linear with the area in contact with the surface, which is what you would expect. And you can change the stiffness of these viscoelastic elements to change them by at least one order of magnitude, maybe two. At some point it becomes too stiff and things break apart. And you always get this linear relationship. You can't, it's very hard to transmit. And the reason is, these cells, you know, they don't exert really strong forces. And it's all sort of a slow process. So it starts to pull or push on another cell. The other cell has time to adapt and modify its shape according to those forces.
Could it be that in response to the cyclic AMP wave that a cell initially stiffens and then a cell crawls up?
Yeah, no, that's the other
cell
thing.
There's always a cell behind you, and it tries to crawl over.
Yeah, no, that's the other. That's the other thing, and I'll talk about that in just a second.
But did you know the shape doesn't change?
No, the cells, they're always ellipsoids, but they can be squished.
No, I mean in these experiments of these.
They're always these slugs. Yeah, there are slugs in these. The individual cells can change. It's
the slug shape doesn't.
That's correct.
As volume increases, the shape doesn't change.
Well, the length changed. No, I agree with that. Yeah.
Well, it could be that if you just kept adding
I'll talk
more
about
volume,
I agree with fully. That's right. So there are two possibilities. The first possibility we considered is you have some cells which are frozen, they're sort of stiff and they're not moving, and so they form some sort of network internal to the structure, and so you can push on those cells and transmit your force. And so we tried simulations like that. It's very easy, freezing some of the cells and not having them fixed and solid. And others, and it becomes very hard to keep the slug coherent when you do that. The slug will fall apart when you do it in a scale, so we can get the sparing theme. And so we think that is not likely at all. The other case is what you're saying. So see, they put these in they drill these holes, and from the paper they didn't tell me all the diameters of the holes. So I don't. But you know, if you force them all through a certain diameter hole, well, then you're going to have some relationship between your surface area, and if you always have the same diameter of the cylindrical shape. But the other question is, what is the naturally occurring shape of a slug? Is there some sort of aspect ratio? Do you have really fat, short slugs, or really long, narrow slugs? And so again, anyway, they're naturally occurring slugs. This is the width versus the length. There's some sort of relationship. There's some sort of aspect ratio to these naturally occurring slugs. And so we think this is what they're really seeing. So if you look at the ratio, if you plot all sorts of shapes, really fat slugs, really narrow, small slugs, you get this sort of a graph. So the lines are when you fix the height. If you fix the height, then of course the surface area is all you're changing, and that's why you get these linear pieces, but you should just consider this as a whole blob of data. But then if you take the window of the naturally occurring slugs in this aspect ratio of what I just showed before from the data, from in a way where they have them, then you have this data, and you might well think that this is a linear relationship. And so the end result is, although the relationship isn't linear with respect to volume, that's a reasonable approximation because naturally occurring slugs have this natural aspect ratio. But the real relationship is really with the surface area. And that's what it is. So then the other thing I wanted to talk about is what I'm trying to do right now, which is these sheets. So in these sheets, originally in 2000, they had the question of, is it the front edge of the cells pulling all the other cells, or are a whole bunch of them pushing in? And so they did various experiments. And the first one is they inhibited a rack in the first three rows, which inhibits movement, I guess pseudopod formation and movement, and it did not heal. But then if you just inhibit it in the first row of cells next to the wound, it still heals. And so from this they conclude, ah, well, there it's not just the leading cells which are pulling it in and dragging all the other ones, but there's a margin of cells moving in. And they've done some more work. So when, at this point they were saying, okay, but what, you could conceive that when you straighten this out, there's some sort of pressure with these cells. And so, see, there's no proliferation here. So they sort of spread back out and fill the region. So is it just sort of this random motion and the fact that you have released the tension here and so it sort of flows back into that region naturally? Is that a question? And they have a paper in 2005 where they've actually ruled that out. But that was the first thing I was thinking of doing on the paper. And so, you know, then I can do movies of this sort of setup where you have these and you sort of compress them in and then you scrape out a region and watch them move. And this just has random motion and no adhesion. But of course, my initial thought was, well, with the random motion, so it has to be more complicated. I need to put barriers here on all sides so the motion is biased to the internal. But even if you have that with adhesion, you might think that it's going to be hard for all these cells to pull. All, you know, if they're all sort of randomly jiggling around, the net motion's not going to be very much. But the more interesting question, which I actually want to, and I can address, and I think we'll be interested in, is what is the signal drawing them in? So is it chemotactic, or is it what has been discussed here, you know, when cells feel forces, they change. And so is the fact that since there's less force on this side, is that the signal which is causing me to move in this direction? Well, I can calculate all the forces on these cells, and so I can see, you know, what the magnitude of the force difference is at different layers away from the wound, and put in rules to say, okay, the cell will orient according to a force difference, and see if I can replicate the sort of experiments they have, and hopefully say something about the difference between a force relationship. You know, if the force is causing me to move because there's a difference on force on one side versus the other, or if there really should be some sort of chemoattractant causing me to move into the wound region. And so this is what I'm quite interested in this summer. Yes. Yeah, no, they do leave some parts of cells, which either way, and I don't know the details of that. I do know that other experiments that they've done, they've not only inhibited motion in the cells, they've actually killed the cells nearby. And if you don't kill them, if you kill just the first layer of cells, it still closes, it will just push those in, and that doesn't bother.
So then when those cells get pushed in,
I don't know what happens to the dead. But one of the speculations is that the fragments of these cells, when you scrape it out, the fragments of the cells release something, and that could be the signal which is drawing them in. That's one of the speculations, but I don't know.
And so, not being a virologist, I'm just wondering how closely this actually resembles what you would see in wound healing side of events. Like, are these just cells sort of?
No, well, I think it's actually a reasonable thing. If you have a very superficial sort of scrape, that's exactly what's, you know, you have this top in your epidermis. If you scrape the cells off, they're just taking a thin layered epidermal cell and scraping a layer off. That's sort of exactly what would happen here. But if you cut very deep, then it's different. It's this dermal wound.
I thought that if you lost a layer of cells, don't all of your skin cells eventually go away and they're replaced?
Well, yeah, so I don't know all of this, but the epidermis, yeah. So the top few layers of the epidermis are actually dead cells they relieve, and they're sort of flaking off all
everybody
the time.
Everybody with the very most basal layer of dead. And so when you scrape off, of course, you scrape off the dead cells, and you scrape off the germinative layer. Those cells form ruffles and they'll put you at the free edge of the cut, and then they begin motile activity. They don't like free edges, I think, or there's some rule they shouldn't ever have one. They should always have these so-called tight junctions, so they start ruffling and moving. Once they contact each other, they've been to reestablish junction. And they probably, I know in some tissue culture cells, or many kinds, they actually underlap. So if there's dead cells, my guess is that the living cells,
yeah,
on that, they actually push the other ones away from the dish and kind of go
push them up on top. That's right. That's so in the experiments in 2005, they actually can visualize the lamellipodia underneath even live cells.
Yeah.
So that's how
they do move underneath,
pushing them out. That's right. Yes.
In this simulation, I mean, how much of it is actually caused by pushing, and how much is like, you know, just random motion?
In this, it's all random motion because I have no pushing.
So,
but I don't know that in terms of the real situation,
yeah,
you have these boundaries, and this is something I can
understand.
But if you put the adhesion and the random motion and the sort of compression because you have these rigid boundaries, I would be interested to see how far the cells can just migrate in with, under those sorts of circumstances.
Oh, I see, okay.
Yes.
Can you also model dermal wound healing?
Oh, not yet. That's what I'm. So with dermal wound healing, it's the cell extracellular matrix interactions which are more important. So for the forces. So I've done stuff with biochemical sort of modeling of this in other modeling that I've done. But what I'm interested in doing is for these force interactions with the dermis, but then I have to have the extracellular matrix, which is different from the cell. So right now this is just cell, and now I want to incorporate this. Now that I have this formulation, I can incorporate it with another thing with the dermis and sort of see the interaction between those two.
So the myofibroblasts are acting on the filaments, so that's moving along in the direction between them.
That's well. So well, so they act more. I think they act more on the filaments than on each other, and that's what. So I need to sort of merge these two, where there's a formulation of the extracellular matrix as this fibrous structure, and then these cells which exert forces, and then I can look at those. And that's really what I'm quite interested. That's where I. That's sort of when I got into this. That's where I wanted to head. I just sort of got stuck in various.